Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Election Day is now just 25 days away, and early voting for statewide and legislative races is underway. How are the races for governor, lieutenant governor, the U.S. Senate, and the U.S. House unfolding during this campaign season? And have there been any big surprises in these contests? And what will be the key factors that will help determine the outcome of these races? Well, today on Vermont Edition, we've got a special roundtable to look at these and many other questions. And these are folks who've been following these campaigns very closely. With us are Paul Heintz, a reporter for 7 Days, Xander Landon, a reporter for VT Digger, and former Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Great to have all of you on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to be here, Bob. Good afternoon, Bob.
Let's start off with the race for governor. The major party candidates in the race are incumbent Republican Phil Scott, who is seeking his second term in office, and he's being challenged by Democrat Christine Hallquist. Xander, these two candidates met in a debate sponsored by VT Digger on Wednesday night in Rutland. What were your general impressions of that debate?
Well, I think we saw a lot of the same arguments coming from both sides that we've seen, you know, since the campaigning has been going on in the last few months. Essentially, Christine Hallquist is making the argument that Phil Scott's cost control measures, his attempts to hold the line on tax increases, isn't doing enough for the vulnerable population he says he's, you know, setting out to protect. She obviously is pointing out things that he's done, like his vetoes of the minimum wage and paid family leave bills. And she's saying that, you know, there are some, quote, strategic investments that she would be making that he's not. You know, she wants to offer, you know, free higher education for low and middle income Vermonters. She wants to change the way that we pay for education by switching to the income tax instead of the property tax, which she says will make, you know, everyone, make sure everyone's paying a more fair share of their earnings, you know, towards paying for education. And, you know, we saw Phil Scott touting his fiscal conservatism and saying that, you know, we need to continue to hold the line on taxes in the way that I've successfully been able to do so, with $70 million in property taxes being offset by his actions. And essentially he's saying, if we want people to stay here and to, you know, move in, we have to have an affordable state. And so that we've been hearing these economic arguments. I feel like that was sort of a big part of this debate, as it has been since the beginning.
Paul, what are your general thoughts about the way that this campaign has developed since the primary election, which was roughly 7 weeks ago?
Well, I think that one of the most interesting and notable parts of this campaign is just how little of substance we've really heard from either of the two major party candidates for governor. Both Christine Hallquist and Governor Phil Scott seem to have these sort of broad outlines of plans, but they haven't put a lot of meat on the bones. In some cases, they haven't really identified entirely how they're going to pay for a particular program. And how much that program would cost. So, you know, I think you see that a lot in campaigns. Obviously, it's no huge surprise. It's perhaps a little bit more surprising coming from an incumbent governor who should, you know, theoretically have the resources to figure out answers to those questions. But, you know, I think we just haven't seen the specifics that I think would really liven up a debate.
Eric, has there been any big surprise in this campaign for you so far?
Not really. I mean, compared to some previous cycles, this campaign seems very low-key. Looking back at governor elections in recent years, it seems the most intensely competitive elections are those when we have open seats. And when it's an incumbent running for re-election, there seems to be less competition and perhaps less interest, too. The other thing which I find interesting about this year's cycle in general is certainly there is high interest in politics, especially national politics. I mean, national polls indicate people are following news, are enthusiastic about voting, whatever side they're on. But it seems that the intensity of interest in the Vermont races just isn't there this year, that the political energy in the state seems to be directed much more at the national level than it is at the state level.
And certainly the development of a long-term funding source to help clean up Lake Champlain and other lakes and streams in Vermont is a key issue in this race. Treasurer Beth Pierce says the state needs to spend about $25 million a year in each of the next 20 years to do this job. Phil Scott says the state has the money in the short term to properly fund this effort, and he opposes creating a new tax as the long-term funding source.
We're spending more money in the last 2 years than a 70% increase over previous years. So I'm committed to water quality and water quality funding. I'm just not interested in providing another tax.
Christine Hallquist says a new revenue source will probably be needed, but she's not going to be specific about that.
I'm not going to sit here and define where that's going to come from, because that's the type of leadership that doesn't work. That's called command and control. We all have to get together and agree where that money's going to come from. And there are lots of good ideas where it can come from, but ultimately it's going to be a collaborative decision.
So, Xander, is this part of this debate whether or not everybody in the state of Vermont should be paying for this, or just the people who live in the affected areas?
You know, it's interesting that we're hearing both sides sort of become very, quiet on this issue in terms of where the money's going to come from. Phil Scott has been saying that he has been mulling a few funding sources within the existing budget, but he's not saying what those are. And his justification for that is that he doesn't want those ideas to be subjected to political attacks. He knows that that's probably what's likely going to happen if he comes out now and says where the source is coming from. We just heard the same thing in that clip of Hallquist saying we need to work together to find a funding source. She's not coming forward with one either. This has obviously been an issue for a long time. Where do we find the money to do this? Both candidates are sort of, not coming forward, with specific plans.
And today in the program, we are looking at the big four races, the race for governor, lieutenant governor, U.S. Senate, and U.S. House. Another key issue in this race is health care. Hallquist says she supports a Medicare for All plan, which is basically a government finance system that covers everyone.
What I'm going to tell voters is they should never accept no for an answer until we get there. I will work hard to get us there, and I will. I think it's going to happen through a coalition with other states.
But Phil Scott says it's a huge mistake for Vermont to try to set this system up on its own or as part of a regional solution. He says it must be done at the federal level.
Because we as a state, we would be uncompetitive with other states, with other regions. We're already suffering from an affordability crisis here in Vermont, where we're not competitive with other regions of our country.
Paul, I have to tell you, when I interviewed Phil Scott on this question, I was a little surprised when he said to me, if there was a federal solution for Medicare for All, I would support it. I just don't want it done on the state or regional basis.
Well, that's a pretty easy thing to say, because I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon at the federal level. I think Phil Scott learned a pretty important lesson from the Shumlin administration, which is that healthcare is extraordinarily difficult. Governor Shumlin made some pretty enormous pledges and commitments and didn't follow through on them. Governor Scott has really done quite the opposite. He has avoided that issue like the plague, and I think it's probably served him well politically. Hallquist, on the other hand, says, "Listen, you got to start trying at the very least, and you got to start working toward a Medicare for All system, whether that's at the state level or through many states." I think she's trying to capitalize on sort of renewed enthusiasm for this concept, which I think really was popularized by Senator Bernie Sanders. At the same time, there's some risk, and I think she's aware of that, of overcommitting and overpromising in an election in Vermont, where it's pretty difficult to get radical or larger reforms done.
Eric, we've seen in a number of places, and Xander was pointing this out earlier, where Christine Hallquist is not very specific about funding sources. We noticed that in water quality. We noticed that in this healthcare discussion, also in the funding of schools across the state. She says she'd like to move to an income-based system, but isn't quite sure how fast it ought to go or how it ought to operate. She has another idea for higher education that she says will be financed in part by reducing the state's corrections budget. Do you think that this approach, this idea of having a more collaborative approach, will resonate with voters, or will voters say, hey, you got to tell us how you're going to pay for it?
Yeah, I think voters would like to hear more detail. What strikes me about the Hultquist campaign is, you know, she's someone who's never run for office before, never served in the legislature. And she has a very thin staff in terms of developing policy. So I think some of what we're seeing in the vagueness about her responses to issues is, one thing, she wants to be deliberately vague so as not to alienate people before the election. Where she does talk about issues, she's highlighting those things that the legislature passed last year and the governor then vetoed, such as an increase in the minimum wage or the paid family leave program. And I think the rest of it she would like to leave as open as possible. On the healthcare issue, for example, while the Green Mountain Care Board has been trying to push back against the hospitals and the insurance companies on budget increases and rate increases, healthcare is continuing to increase faster than people's incomes. For next year, whether it's individuals who buy their policies on their own or employers who pay for group coverage, it looks like most insurance in Vermont is going to go up by somewhere between 5 and 8%, depending on the particular mix of benefits involved in the policy. And that's roughly twice as much as incomes are increasing in Vermont. And it would seem to me that if she wants to talk about affordability, one of the things she can talk about is the steadily rising cost of healthcare in Vermont, how it's outpacing income. And if she has some more specific things, I mean, there's some ideas in the legislature, for example, that began to be talked about last year about if we're not going to go all the way toward a single payer, maybe we can start with some sort of funded universal primary care system. And it strikes me as that's the sort of thing more specific that she could be talking about and use it as a way of focusing in on the affordability issue.
Let's go to our callers and start with Alton, who is calling from Wolcott. Hey, Alton, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. A big issue for me is the treatment of our ridgelines. I'm not opposed to wind power. I've seen plenty of windmills in the West, and they put them on the bench lines out there. I can say I've never seen a wind tower in the West on a mountain. And yet we allowed people to come in here from Canada and blow up the top of the Lowell Range. And I think, you know, we made a decision that was for short-term gain and long-term loss. People will go up there 500 years from now and say, what were they thinking? Anyway, what if Worcester, for example, can't keep up with their, do their renewable energy quota for their town or their area? What would the candidates say about putting windmills on the Worcester Range?
Okay, Alton, we'll try to find out for you. Paul, has renewable energy emerged as much of an issue in this campaign?
No, I don't think it's been a real focus this time around. You know, I can't imagine that either candidate would support that sort of proposal. But, you know, we've seen this issue, which has been really divisive in recent years, not play as big a role in this campaign cycle, at least as far as I've seen.
And Eric, usually governors, when they campaign for a second term in office, they win. I mean, it's been, 55 or 60 mm-hmm. years since an incumbent governor was defeated for re-election. Is part of the framework of this debate that Christine Hultquist has to convince voters that Scott is not deserving of a second term in office?
Yes, and that's somewhat of a difficult task for her because she has admitted that she voted for Phil Scott 2 years ago. And the subject has come up in the debate, and it's come up in some of the interviews that she's done with the media. And listening to her responses, I think she needs to work a little bit more on being more specific on the question, why, if you supported Phil Scott 2 years ago, don't you believe he deserves another term now? She talks about some of the specific issues, but I'd like to hear her talk more about the governor's overall philosophy, management style, and so forth.
So, Xander, in the end, What are a couple of the factors that you think will be the key issues in this campaign that will help people decide who they're going to vote for?
I think it's really, you know, the line of attack from Hultquist, as I said earlier, has really been on the economy. And I think Phil Scott's, you know, appeal to Vermonters has been about his economic vision, too. And I think it's about being able to sell, you know, who can sell their vision for Vermont's economy better. I think one thing that we've seen Hultquist sort of bring to the table that's very different is her broadband plan, her plan to expand broadband to rural areas. And she's sort of pinning a lot on this plan, which involves basically requiring utilities to install the infrastructure in order to make it more affordable and easy to do so. She's saying that if we expand internet connectivity to you know, rural communities that don't have it right now, you're going to see people come in and, you know, basically populate the schools that are struggling with low enrollment right now. And we're going to see farmers have new opportunities to market their products online. And that basically it's, in a way, it's sort of a panacea for a lot of problems. And, you know, so she's offering different ideas, like, you know, we were talking about, like the higher education plan. And, you know, Phil Scott is sort of staying, you know, in his lane. And he's unwavering in his insistence that we have to keep Vermont affordable by holding the line on increases in taxes and fees. So I think that's really what it comes down to.
Let's turn to Linda, who's calling from Stowe. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Hello. Yeah, I don't know if it's a question or a comment. I think all candidates for almost any office should be talking about everybody wants, you know, says we have to attract more younger people and workers and entrepreneurs and create jobs and grow the economy. And but all those people, they got to live somewhere. And we already don't have housing for people that are looking for places to live and, you know, affordable or medium income housing. And if you build more houses or apartments, or, you know, where are you going to put them? You know, what's going to happen to all the green space? And then these people are going to need electricity and roads and parking lots and driveways and water and add on to the sewer systems of the cities where they live, and that's already not adequate for what we got here now. How are we going to attract people here if we don't have all the amenities for them?
Linda, we appreciate your call very much. Paul, Phil Scott's been talking about this, sort of the aging demographic of Vermont. It's projected over the next 10 or 15 years that the overall population of the state is going to increase about 1%. And the number of people over 65, that population is going to increase by about 50%. So bringing young people into the state has been a focus for Phil Scott. Does he have a concrete plan to do it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're right that this has been a big focus of his. In fact, I think after the affordability concept, the thing he most frequently discusses is the demographic challenge that the state faces. You know, one of the things that he's pointed to a lot as far as a success in this past term is the pretty significant housing bond that he and Democratic legislative leaders agreed on pretty early on in the biennium. And he sees that as a success that has driven some more home building in the area. You know, as far as Christine Hultquist, as Xander pointed out, you know, she often goes back to the idea of broadband, universal broadband, and sees that as the answer.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, we're looking at Election Day. It's 3.5 weeks away. How are some of these statewide races evolving? With me today, Xander Landon, a reporter for VT Digger, former Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis, and Paul Heintz, a reporter for 7 Days. Let's look at the race for lieutenant governor. This face features incumbent progressive Democrat one-term David Zuckerman, and the Republican candidate is House Minority Leader Don Turner. Zuckerman says he supports a plan to have all homeowners pay their school taxes based on their incomes and not the value of their property. And roughly 65% of all homeowners in the state pay this way in a program known as income sensitivity. Zuckerman thinks that all homeowners should pay the same income tax rate.
As you go up into the 200,000, 600,000, and 800,000 income families, the percentage they pay for schools drops way below the approximate 3% that most Vermonters pay. There was a bill that would generate a similar tax rate for everybody and would shift about $30 million onto lower taxes for working class Vermonters.
But Turner opposes this plan, and he argues that property tax rates could be lower if school spending was brought under control.
But I totally disagree with the Lieutenant Governor on shifting. The funding formula that we have, I think, is broken. It's outlived its life. It is unfair. It's unsustainable. The funding, current funding formula is not fair to students, teachers, or taxpayers.
Paul, how do you see this race shaping up?
Well, I think in some ways this is the most interesting race, philosophically speaking. These are two candidates who are pretty diametrically opposed on most issues. The strange exception is that they both got together very briefly to support the taxation and regulation of marijuana after it became clear that small amounts of marijuana were going to be legalized in the state. But, you know, other than that issue, they're really quite the opposite. So I think it's been an opportunity for, you know, a pretty sharp contrast. I would say that Don Turner, who is the minority leader of the Vermont Republicans in the Vermont House, seems to be running a very vigorous campaign. He seems to have, you know, if lawn signs could vote, which I know they don't, he'd be doing pretty darn well right now. That said, David Zuckerman has been, you know, around the state for a very long time and has done remarkably well in did remarkably well 2 years ago when he first ran for lieutenant governor. So, you know, I think it's going to be an uphill climb for Mr. Turner, but it's a very interesting debate.
Eric, in this race, Bernie Sanders has endorsed Zuckerman. He's going to be doing some campaign appearances with him. How much does that help Zuckerman?
I think it helps him at the margin. I mean, this weekend, for example, there's going to be an event where Bernie Sanders will campaign on behalf of Zuckerman. Zuckerman, though, has demonstrated a pretty broad geographical appeal in his previous campaigns. It was very interesting looking in 2016, for example, that Zuckerman did considerably better in the more rural parts of the state than Sue Minter, the Democratic candidate for governor, 2 years ago. So Zuckerman has those advantages of incumbency and familiarity. I think the fact that he is a working farmer, again, helps him at the margin with some constituents in Vermont. One of the things I find very interesting about this is the two very contrasting patterns of fundraising that the candidates are using. I think they'll both end up spending roughly the same amount of money, maybe Turner a little bit more. But Zuckerman's campaign is almost entirely funded by individual donations, most of them from within Vermont, most of them of $200 or less. Turner's campaign is funded mostly by large dollar donations, some of them from within Vermont, the $1,000 and up, some of them from outside organizations, PACs and other such organizations. And, you know, this two very different strategies, one a grassroots style, one a large dollar, to some extent, out-of-state funding style. It'll be interesting what the voters have to say about these two styles when they cast their ballots for this office over the next month or so.
And, Xander, is this a case where Turner has basically adopted the issue playbook from Phil Scott, affordability, affordability, affordability?
It seems like that's the case, and obviously he was a stalwart on those issues in the legislature as House Minority Leader, and leading the House in sort of resisting a lot of liberal priorities, the minimum wage priority and paid family leave and all the vetoes that we saw. Phil Scott, hand down, he voted, you know, to support those vetoes, and ultimately was the one who sort of sealed the deal on a lot of those decisions, on you know, the governor's budget decisions too. I think that he's sort of that's what we're seeing a lot from his campaign. And as Eric said, you know, there's been a lot of even outside money coming into his race, which is very interesting. We saw the National Association of Realtors spend $55,000 on online ads for the campaign. We see ads on television. So that's definitely, you know, something he's using to tout that message of affordability. But I was talking to Shap Smith yesterday. He ran against Zuckerman, the incumbent, in 2016 for the lieutenant governor's in the lieutenant governor's race. And he said that, you know, a lot of people were surprised, as you were suggesting, that Zuckerman had such broad support outside of Chittenden County. And he was saying that, you know, a lot of the issues that he was that he was known for in the legislature, he thinks, like GMO labeling, supporting, leading the charge on that, cannabis reform, sort of got him a lot of name recognition. And, you know, he's a pretty popular politician in the state, so it's definitely an uphill battle for Turner.
Today on the program, we're looking at the big statewide races. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Bill, who is calling from Shaftesbury. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, and good afternoon. I have a question for all of you. It doesn't strike me that Christine Hallquist knows anything about how a government runs, and I'd like your comment on how important it is to have a background in how a government is supposed to run before you take over a spot such as being governor of a state. And I'll hang up on that. Thank you.
All right, Bill. Thanks for your phone call. Eric Davis, what do you think?
Well, I would say Christine Hallquist does have managerial experience. She was the CEO of the Vermont Electric Co-op. That company was in pretty bad shape when she was brought in to be the CEO. When she left, the company's finances were much better. Their bond rating was improved and so forth. And I think that that sort of experience managing a complex organization and getting it out of financial difficulty is relevant to being governor.
Paul, as I mentioned right at the very beginning of the program, early voting has started, and it's estimated that it may be as many as 30% of all voters will cast their ballot before November 6th. If that's the case, how does that affect campaign strategy, where they're going to spend money? Does it start to change things for candidates?
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes it's a new day for campaigns as early voting has grown nationally and in Vermont. You can no longer kind of time things out, assuming that everyone's going to make their decision around the same time. So, you know, it's also an opportunity for campaigns that are stronger organizationally. So those who are good at getting their core supporters to request absentee ballots and then make sure that those absentee ballots are delivered to town clerks, that they will do far better. So, you know, it's definitely a different dynamic. You know, I think as someone who is a big fan of democracy, I think anything that makes it easier to vote makes it is probably a positive thing. So, you know, hopefully it will increase turnout overall.
Eric, early in the program, you talked about voter turnout may be strong in different states around the country. What do you think about Vermont? Do you think that same dynamic exists here, that people really want to participate in this election? And if that's the case, who does it help?
Well, first of all, I'll note nationally, turnout in midterms tends to fall off between 10 and 15% from the preceding presidential election. Most people who look at national turnout projections for this year say that while there will be a fall off, it may not be as great as the normal presidential to midterm cycle, that it might be an 8 to 10 point drop off, say, rather than a 10 to 15. The interesting question for me in Vermont, and this is one I can't answer now, and we'll see the numbers when the turnout numbers come in on election day, is that we do not have what I think almost no political observer would say that we have competitive races for either the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate here in Vermont. And what's driving the turnout nationally are competitive races for the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. Can the Democrats regain control of one or both of the chambers of Congress this November? That question is really not at issue in Vermont. So will the governor's races and some closely contested legislative races in particular areas of the state? I mean, we have a state Senate race in Addison County where I live with six candidates, two Democrats, two independents, a Republican and a Libertarian. And it looks like, based on the financial reports so far, there could be $100,000 to $125,000 spent collectively among those candidates, which would be huge for a state Senate race, and some of that will go into turnout. But other than pockets like that, I just don't know whether the intense interest in the question of who will control the House, who will control the Senate, is going to impact the level of turnout here in Vermont.
I think I actually disagree with that, Eric. I mean, obviously, we don't have the kind of turnout operations that you're seeing in battleground states, mm-hmm. with competitive House and Senate races. But I think one thing that we are seeing is such a tremendous energy at the grassroots level to be involved in politics in one way or another. And I think this is inspired by Donald Trump on the whole and on both sides. I mean, I think that he's inspiring his base to be more active, and he's certainly inspiring those who oppose him and his policies to be more active. You saw that with the tremendous turnout at rallies such as the Women's March in recent years. And, you know, anecdotally around Vermont, I'm seeing a lot of evidence of people who are involved in campaigns outside of the state, people who are donating money to, you know, the Texas Senate race, for example, you know, and writing postcards or sending text messages to campaigns elsewhere. And I think those people are so focused on the energy on the election writ large that they will certainly turn out to vote. I think they'll inspire their friends to turn out to vote. I think so I do think turnout will be you know, a good bit higher than one would typically expect in a year like this.
Yes, and I'll just pick up on one point you made, Paul, that the interest of Vermonters in races in other states is something that has definitely struck me. I gave a talk to a group over in Montpelier a couple of days ago, and afterward a few people came up to me and said, can you give us the lists of the House races or the Senate races that you think are the closest, where if we want to give money, we should send money to candidates in these races? And yeah, there's even though the election for the single Senate seat in Vermont and the single House seat in Vermont aren't going to affect control of those chambers, there's very, very great interest in the question. And I know there are Vermonters who are going to New Hampshire or upstate New York to support candidates there with grassroots campaigning.
I do think it's a very good question, though, how, you know, if it is the case that turnout is higher than one might expect, how that then affects Vermont campaigns. How does that affect Vermont's gubernatorial race, for example? And that's a big unknown. I wouldn't hazard a prediction there. You know, I think there are a lot of people saying 2 years ago that Sue Minter had an advantage in some ways because Donald Trump was seen as so unpopular in Vermont. You know, as it turned out, Donald Trump did really poorly in Vermont, but Phil Scott, also a Republican, did tremendously well. So, you know, as is a cliche in Vermont, ticket splitting is a thing that many, if not most, Vermonters like to do. So, you know, we can't necessarily extrapolate that this sort of energy that seems to be stronger on the left is necessarily going to help out down ticket candidates in Vermont.
Yeah, and I think that more people sort of who maybe wouldn't have been engaged unless Trump was in office heading to the polls could certainly help Hallquist in theory. But at the same time, we see that his approval rating, which had taken a pretty large plummet earlier, and largely that was attributed to his decision to sign the gun laws, the pollsters that conducted that poll, Morning Consult, we've seen that number is now going up and stabilizing a little bit. And so it's unclear, you know, and I was talking to moderates at the polls who were voting for Scott in the primary, moderate Democrats casting Republican ballots because they, you know, respected the governor's decision to make that, you know, decision on guns and his, you know, fiscal conservatism in office. And so it's, you know, it's sort of unclear how we're going to see that pan out.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we're looking at the big statewide races that will be decided in just 3.5 weeks. With us today, former Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis, Paul Heintz, a reporter for 7 Days, and Xander Landon, a reporter for VT Digger. Looking at that U.S. Senate race, Bernie Sanders is seeking his third term in the U.S. Senate, and this is why Sanders says he's running this year.
Sadly, at the top of the list is to the need to defeat the agenda of the most reactionary president in the modern history of the United States of America. What I'm doing is trying to defeat the divisiveness, the racism, the sexism, the homophobia, the religious bigotry.
Now, Sanders is being challenged by Republican businessman Lawrence Zupan. He says he totally disagrees with what he calls Sanders' socialist approach to the role of government.
I am suggesting that he loves a system that's anathema and foreign to our system more, as defined by his love and his promulgation of socialism at every single drop of the hat wherever he goes.
Eric, it does seem that Bernie Sanders is spending more time working to elect Democratic candidates around the country than he is campaigning here. Lawrence Zupan wants to make this a big issue. Will he be successful?
I don't think so. I think Vermonters admire Bernie Sanders' role nationally. I mean, that was seen when he ran for president last year, the very large support he received in the Democratic primary in March of 2016. I think it was seen by the number of people who wrote in his name on the general election ballot last November. And I think Bernie is, you know, obviously his time is a great resource, and there are people around the country who want it, who want him to appear for them. There are people here in Vermont, not just lieutenant governor, but legislative candidates who would like him to appear on their behalf. He's perceived as having coattails, and in my view, that perception is correct. The one thing which I do find fascinating about this is there are 9 candidates listed on the ballot for U.S. Senate. 1 Republican, 1 Liberty Union, and 7 independents, including Senator Sanders. Every candidate that Senator Sanders is campaigning on behalf of for the U.S. House, U.S. Senate, and even some other offices is running as a Democrat. Yet, still now, his statewide career is more than 30 years old. He's never listed himself as a Democrat on a statewide general election ballot in Vermont. And it's paradoxical that he'll run for re-election and almost certainly be re-elected as an independent in Vermont, then join the Democratic caucus in the Senate, which he's been a member of ever since he went there, and perhaps run for the Democratic presidential nomination again in 2020.
Paul, what does your gut tell you about Bernie Sanders in 2020? Right now, he says he's focused entirely on the race for 2018 in this Senate race, but we know that his advisors are talking behind the scenes about setting up a strategy for 2020. What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, I think it's very clear that Senator Sanders wants to run for president again in 2020. He's doing all of the things that a prospective candidate would do, whether that is campaign across the country in the lead up to a midterm election, as he's doing, publishing a book, writing frequent op-eds and getting on the Sunday morning shows, all that stuff. He's doing all of it. I think that he developed a real thirst for running for president last time around, and I think he was, tremendously successful. I think for someone who was written off and discounted over and over again by those who think they understand politics, he showed that there was a real yearning for the kind of politics that he has represented for decades. So I got to imagine it's quite alluring to get back in the mix. The problem for Sanders, I think, in 2020 is that it's such a different playing field this time around. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons, and this is not, to undermine what Sanders accomplished, but one of the reasons he did so well last time around the primary was that there really weren't very many options because people expected Hillary Clinton to win the Democratic nomination. Very few other people challenged her. And so there was a real opening for someone like Sanders. This time around, it's going to be very different. There are probably 20 Democrats who are taking a very serious look at running. Perhaps you could argue that that's now an advantage for Sanders since he has higher name recognition. He's done this before. But I think it could also be a challenge as the Democratic Party looks for a fresher voice, fresher face. And I think you can't ignore the fact that, a Democratic Party that is more and more reliant upon the votes of women and non-white voters, I think it would be perhaps difficult for someone, who is a white male in his 70s to win the Democratic nomination this time around.
Let's take a quick look at the race for U.S. House. In this contest, 6-term incumbent Democrat Peter Welch is being challenged by first-time candidate Anya Tina. She says Welch's opposition to the GOP tax bill is one of the biggest issues in her campaign.
It is time for a new representation just because Peter Welch has demonstrated that he's out of touch with the everyday Vermonter. He voted against the Tax and Jobs Act. We have workers in many companies that have received benefits from the Tax and Jobs Act because it was passed without his vote.
Welch says he voted against that tax bill because most of the benefits are targeted to big corporations and wealthy people.
That tax bill is an abomination. I mean, this is a bill that is going to add $2.3 trillion to our deficit. the vast majority of the benefit, about 83% of the benefit, went to corporations in the wealthiest 1% in the country.
So, Zander, does Republican candidate Anya Tino have a pretty big challenge here?
I would say absolutely. I think where she's sort of been gaining a lot of attention is the fact that she's young and has energy and is clearly pretty intelligent young person. She has no name recognition. I think she works in advertisement up in the Northeast Kingdom. She's 25. Peter Welch has been in office for years, very broadly popular. Most Vermonters are not Trump supporters, and clearly Congressman Welch has actively resisted the Trump administration and their legislative priorities. So I think she certainly has an uphill battle. I'm sure that – I actually haven't seen her campaign finance filings, but I can't imagine that it matches what Peter Welch has in the bank and his resources. So I think it's a completely – it would be quite an upset if we saw her win this election.
And Eric, I'm wondering, what's the biggest surprise that you think might happen on Election Day here in Vermont? Not that it will, but, you know, it could.
I would say – the biggest surprises might be, I'll list a few. One would be to go back to the Addison County Senate race I just mentioned, that the Democrats who've held both of those seats since 2002 lose one or both of them. I think another thing I'll be looking at very closely is whether Democrats in the House are able to get enough seats coupled with progressive and independent allies to have a better chance of overriding the governor's vetoes next year. I wouldn't call that a surprise if Democrats and their allies did end up having about 101 or 102 seats after the election. But it could end up being 97 or 98. The governor's vetoes would still be sustained. I would say if there were a surprise, unlikely to happen, but not to write it off entirely, it would be Don Turner defeating David Zuckerman for lieutenant governor.
Paul, how about you? Any big surprise that, it might happen?
Well, I hate to make predictions because I'm almost always wrong, but I would say that one surprise that could be pretty interesting is if Democrats end up taking the U.S. Senate back, which is not viewed as terribly likely at the moment, but if they did, that would put Senator Patrick Leahy as the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, which would be quite a boon for Vermont, and it would put Senator Sanders, presumably, as the chair of the Budget Committee. It does seem a lot more likely that the Democrats will take back the U.S. House. So someone like Congressman Welch is probably in a pretty decent position to have a stronger role in the next Congress.
Xander, we're almost out of time, but do you see a big surprise out there?
I'm interested in seeing, I think it is an uphill battle for her, but the extent to which how well Christine Hultquist does in this race, whether we see her capture a large portion of the vote, and we see that sort of as either a referendum on Phil Scott or on Trump, and what the turnout's going to be from basically Democratic voters in the context of all the things we've been talking about, the federal politics and also the local politics.
We're going to be following these races very closely in the next 3.5 weeks. It's going to be fascinating to see the outcome of these races. Many thanks to our panel today. Paul Heinz of 7 Days, Xander Landon of VT Digger, and retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Thank you all very much for a great conversation.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bob.
My pleasure, Bob.